American troops on the U.S. border with Mexico.
President Trump is sending a very strong message to people around this world. If you are thinking about breaking the laws of the United States of America, you will be returned home.
South Korea's former president indicted, charged with leading an insurrection.
Insurrection is one of the few criminal charges from which a South Korean president does not have immunity. It is punishable by life imprisonment or death.
And President Donald Trump meets victims of natural disasters.
Unfortunately, our government failed you, but it wasn't the Trump government. It was a government run by Biden. What a terrible situation.
Today is Monday, January 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. We begin today's show in the U.S., where President Donald Trump has followed through with one of his more controversial campaign promises and declared that a national emergency exists at the United States southern border, and he sent active-duty U.S. military troops to help secure it. However, there are rules about what the troops can and can't do, at least for now. VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb has the details.
1,500 American troops, joining some 2,500 troops already at the southern border with Mexico. White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt.
President Trump is sending a very strong message to people around this world. If you are thinking about breaking the laws of the United States of America, you will be returned home, you will be arrested, you will be prosecuted. Do not come.
The administration says troops directed to the border will help law enforcement take complete control, enhancing detection of migrants and helping install physical barriers. And officials say more troops are expected in the coming weeks. While some of the troops are armed for self-defense, none will be arresting migrants crossing the border because U.S. law prohibits the military from law enforcement activities inside the country. But there are exceptions, such as the Insurrection Act, the president may invoke that might allow the military to perform arrests or searches and seizures inside U.S. territory to help stop what he has called a, quote, invasion. Michael O'Hanlon is with the Brookings Institution.
Trump is not inventing this issue out of thin or whole cloth, but he is clearly willing to do much more in the way of tightening the border than others, especially his Democratic predecessors in the White House.
Additional troops are flying thousands of illegal immigrants detained by Customs and Border Patrol out of the country. A defense official tells VOA the first two flights occurred early Friday and landed in Guatemala. Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
In a related story, top Trump administration officials, including the so-called border czar Tom Homan and the acting deputy attorney general, visited Chicago on Sunday to witness the start of ramped-up immigration enforcement in the nation's third largest city. Few details of the operation were immediately made public, including the number of arrests, but the sheer number of federal agencies involved reveals President Trump's willingness to defy norms and use federal law enforcement beyond the Department of Homeland Security to carry out his long-promised mass deportations. Acting Deputy Attorney General Emil Bove said he observed immigration agents from the Department of Homeland Security, along with agents from the FBI, Drug Enforcement Administration, and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. Meanwhile, it's been a busy weekend in Israel. More Israeli hostages and Palestinian prisoners have been exchanged. There is renewed fighting in parts of Lebanon, and President Trump is asking Arab countries to take in Palestinian refugees. For the latest, I'm joined by VOA's Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
It was four Israeli hostages. There were a total of five young female Israeli soldiers who what were called surveillance spotters who worked on a base right near Gaza, and they were kidnapped, taken in their pajamas. There was video of them having been, you know, some of them had blood on them. And the four of them were released. They were dressed in sort of fake Israeli uniforms. They were paraded through the streets of Gaza. They gave a sort of press conference in Gaza in which they told about how well they were treated by Hamas, and then they were reunited with their families, very emotional, both for the families and really for everyone. These are young women, 19 and 20, you know, who had spent almost 16 months in Hamas captivity. Now, the hiccup was with a civilian named Arbel Yehud, who was supposed to be part of this first release. She was supposed to be released before these Israeli soldiers, but she's apparently held by Islamic Jihad and not by Hamas. So she wasn't released. And then Israel said it will not open the road to allow Palestinians to return to Gaza until at least there's information about what's going on with her. Now, the latest with that is that there are these intensive negotiations. Apparently, Islamic Jihad says they have provided the information that she is alive and she is going to be released perhaps even before the next release is scheduled on next Saturday. In addition, Israel released 200 Palestinian prisoners, including about 120 who were serving life sentences for murdering Israelis, in some cases for murdering, you know, 7-10 people.
Now, while all this is happening, shooting has resumed in southern Lebanon, despite a ceasefire agreement there as well. What's that story? What happened?
Well, what happened is that Sunday was the deadline for Israel to pull out of South Lebanon. According to the deal, the Lebanese army was supposed to take over South Lebanon. Hezbollah was supposed to move north of the Litani River, which is about 13 miles north of the border, and Israel would withdraw. And while the Lebanese army has taken over part of the area, Israel says that it hasn't taken over all of it and that it has seen Hezbollah trying to come back to that area in violation of the ceasefire. So Israel said it was going to stay longer than the deadline. It said, according to the ceasefire negotiations, it could do that. Hezbollah disagreed. Hundreds of Lebanese tried to go back to their homes in southern Lebanon. Israel says they were mostly Hezbollah fighters. They had Hezbollah flags. They had pictures of the slain Hezbollah leader, Hassan Nasrallah. Israel warned them several times to stop, and when they didn't stop, opened fire. And Lebanese officials say that 22 people were killed and more than 100 wounded.
So is that where it ends, or is Israel expecting retaliation?
Well, it's not clear. It's not clear exactly what's going to happen. Also, it's not clear that if Hezbollah even could fire rockets, if they want to completely get rid of the ceasefire, which doesn't seem likely. It seems that this is where it ends for now, and there will be negotiations to get the Lebanese army to take over more of the area. Israel says it has no intention of staying in South Lebanon permanently.
Looking back at Gaza, President Trump on Sunday said he spoke to leadership in Jordan and would be contacting leadership in Egypt to resettle Palestinian refugees from Gaza to other countries. This is something that leaders in Gaza have said they definitely do not want. What's behind this? How is it going? And what can we expect to see?
Well, it was a comment made on Air Force One to reporters, and it sounded almost as if it was off the cuff. I mean, that's what it sounded like to me. And he said, President Trump said that there's been so much destruction in Gaza and that we need to, I think he said, clean out the area. It's kind of a non-starter. I mean, for Palestinians, you know, this brings back what they call the Nakba. When Israel was created in 1948, what they call the catastrophe, when like 700,000 Palestinians left their homes in Israel and became refugees. And Palestinians have said they will never let that happen again. The Jordanian foreign minister completely rejected this idea. About 100,000 Palestinians from Gaza have managed to get to Egypt, often by paying a lot of money and bribes and all kinds of things. And they have not been recognized as refugees in Egypt. So it really does not seem like it's much of a, it's kind of a non-starter, actually.
We'll leave it there for today. VOA's Linda Gradstein is in Jerusalem. Linda, thanks for your time. Thanks for your reporting.
Thank you, Steve.
South Korea's impeached president, Yoon Suk-yeol, was indicted Sunday on charges of leading an insurrection with the imposition of martial law back in December. Reuters' Diane To has the latest.
South Korea's prosecutors indicted impeached President Yoon Suk-yeol on Sunday. Yoon's lawyers confirmed that he faces charges of leading an insurrection when he briefly imposed martial law in December. The charges are unprecedented for a South Korean president. If convicted, Yoon could face years in prison. His lawyers criticized the indictment as the worst choice made by prosecutors, while the main opposition party welcomed the decision. Asia's fourth largest economy has been plunged in political chaos since Yoon's martial law decree on December the 3rd, which sought to ban political and parliamentary activity and control the media. Separate to his criminal charges, the Constitutional Court is also in the process of determining whether to remove Yoon from office permanently or reinstate him. That's after Yoon was impeached by parliament in mid-December and suspended from power. At the impeachment trial last week, Yoon and his lawyers argued that he never intended to fully impose martial law, but had only meant the measures as a warning to break a political deadlock. Insurrection is one of the few criminal charges from which a South Korean president does not have immunity. It is punishable by life imprisonment or death, although the country has not executed anyone in decades. A number of top military officials were also indicted for their roles in the alleged insurrection.
That's Diane To of Reuters. And here are some other stories we're following from around the world. President Trump has imposed retaliatory measures on Colombia, including tariffs, sanctions, and a travel ban. This after Bogota turned away two U.S. military aircraft with migrants being deported as part of the administration's immigration crackdown. Trump said the action by Colombian President Gustavo Petro jeopardized U.S. national security. For his part, Petro condemned the practice of using military planes to repatriate migrants, suggesting they were treated like criminals. In a post on the social media platform X, Petro said Colombia would welcome home deported migrants on civilian planes, saying they should be treated with dignity and respect. Belarus's authoritarian president, Alexander Lukashenko, is all but certain to extend his more than three decades in power in Sunday's election. Lukashenko has been in power since 1994 and has ruled the country of 9 million people with an iron hand. After weeks of windy and dry weather, rain has fallen in Southern California. It's expected to aid firefighters who are mopping up multiple wildfires, but potentially heavy downpours on charred hillsides could bring new troubles, such as toxic ash runoff and mudslides. Crews spent much of the past week removing vegetation, shoring up slopes, and reinforcing roads in devastated areas. Most of the region was forecast to get around 2.5 centimeters of precipitation over the next several days. Rainfall that began late Saturday was expected to last into early Tuesday. Flood watches were issued for some burn areas, while snow is likely in the mountains. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish. We'll be looking at what the new Secretary of State might have planned for Africa in a few minutes. First, though, more on the situation in Los Angeles. At the end of last week, President Trump visited areas of the United States affected by natural disasters. North Carolina, which was hard hit by Hurricane Helene last September, and Southern California, where wildfires are still burning. Genia Dulo has our story from L.A.
U.S. President Donald Trump told people in North Carolina that they were treated very badly by former President Joe Biden's administration following last September's Hurricane Helene.
Unfortunately, our government failed you, but it wasn't the Trump government. It was a government run by Biden. What a terrible situation.
Trump was especially critical of the work of the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA. FEMA responded to Hurricane Helene, and the agency's chief of staff during the Biden administration, Michael A. Cohen Jr., said Trump has been misinformed about the agency. Trump told North Carolina officials Friday that he will be signing an executive order to begin overhauling the Federal Emergency Agency.
I think, frankly, FEMA is not good. I think when you have a problem like this, I think you want to go and whether it's a Democrat or Republican governor, you want to use your state to fix it and not waste time calling FEMA.
Landing in Los Angeles, Trump was greeted by California Governor Gavin Newsom.
Thank you for being here. It means a great deal to all of us. We're going to need your support. We're going to need your help.
Trump, accompanied by the First Lady, visited the site of the Palisades fire that took the lives of at least 11 people and destroyed and damaged almost 8,000 structures. After meeting with local residents and first responders at the emergency fire briefing, he said that the federal government is standing behind California 100%.
We're going to essentially waive all federal permits. We're going to have you go very quickly because a federal permit can take 10 years. We're not going to do that. We don't want to take 10 days.
Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass said she would help with that on a local level as well.
We are going to do everything we can, slashing regulations, expediting everything so that people can begin the process right away.
Trump also brought up California water policies he believes resulted in sending too much water into the Pacific Ocean, instead supplying city of Los Angeles and exacerbating the recent wildfires.
I'm signing an executive order to open up the pumps and valves in the north. We want to get that water pouring down here as quickly as possible and let hundreds of millions of gallons of water flow down into Southern California. I tell you, who does like it is the fire department.
While 177 million gallon Santa Ynez Reservoir near Pacific Palisades was closed for repairs when the fire erupted in the area, Leticia Crenier, Water Policy Director of Public Policy Institute of California, said there is no relationship between the fires in Southern California and state rerouting water from the north.
The reservoirs in Southern California are full, and there's not a limitation on water supply there.
A large percentage of the fires in Los Angeles Palisades and the Eaton fire are mostly contained, with 28 fatalities and over 16,000 structures destroyed. The city is looking at a long road of recovery ahead. Jenya Dulo, VOA News, Los Angeles.
The United States has a new chief diplomat now that Marco Rubio has been sworn in as Secretary of State. Rubio has taken a tough stance on China and pledged to advance America's interests abroad, but he's not been specific when it comes to his Africa policy. South Africa's president, though, says he's confident in his country's relationship with the U.S. Kate Bartlett has that story from Johannesburg.
It might have been chilly in Davos, Switzerland, at the recent World Economic Forum, but South African President Cyril Ramaphosa said he expected warm relations with the United States under President Donald Trump.
President Trump is a great deal maker, and so am I. So we will be able to work together.
But not everyone shares his optimism. Analysts predict that Pretoria's cozy relations with Russia, neutral stance on the Ukraine war, an International Court of Justice case against Israel over Gaza won't sit well with the new U.S. administration.
They weren't seen as breaking point questions. Under the Trump administration, they certainly will, as the State Department, be watching that very carefully.
South Africa is also a staunch member of BRICS, the group of emerging nations that includes Russia and China. Secretary of State Rubio has called out South Africa in the past for its warm relations with Beijing.
Now we get the Trump-Vance administration, which is starting very clearly on the foreign policy of America first. So it will mean that if South Africa is pursuing quote-unquote BRICS first policy, it will run counter to this foreign policy and it will be in trouble.
Some Republicans have already called for a full review into relations with South Africa. Some analysts say the U.S. could take punitive action against South Africa for not being aligned with Washington on foreign policy, such as ending trade benefits.
Yeah, I think that this sort of the length of the tether that the U.S. will have is shorter. It's going to be less tolerant of countries that, for example, are major recipients of U.S. aid, but vote against the U.S. at the United Nations.
Hartley says this could either increase U.S. influence in Africa,
or alternatively, it could push these countries out of the U.S. sphere and into embracing alternatives.
Analysts say the U.S. will likely continue with the Lobito Corridor, a railway project to transport critical minerals from Zambia and the Democratic Republic of Congo to Africa's West Atlantic coast. Another big move could be if the U.S. recognizes Somaliland, a self-governing region within Somalia. But all in all, says retired diplomat Spector, Africa is not that high on the agenda.
As far as Africa is concerned, let's be honest and let's be fair about it. Africa is very far down the totem pole of the places and issues that the Trump administration is going to pay attention to.
For his first international trip, Rubio is heading to Panama. Kate Bartlett, VOA News, Johannesburg, South Africa.
And finally today, now that President Bashar al-Assad's long rule in Syria has ended, family members and hostage aid groups are taking the search for missing American journalist Austin Tice to Damascus, checking abandoned prisons for clues. From the Press Freedom Desk, Christina Caicedo-Smith has more.
Armed with flashlights and cameras, members of Hostage Aid Worldwide search this former detention center in the Syrian capital of Damascus. They are looking for signs of Austin Tice, an American journalist taken captive at a checkpoint in 2012. Nizar Zaga is the head of Hostage Aid Worldwide.
This is usually used as a group prison. It will have almost probably 100 person. At when it's crowded, we want to look at the walls to see if there is any writing in English or anything, to see if we had any foreigners in this section.
Saka says he doesn't understand how people survived.
It's really too bad.
In one abandoned facility, the team found graffiti the Tice family believes had been left by Austin. Hostage Aid Worldwide later took his mother, Deborah Tice, to view the markings. Since the fall of President Bashar al-Assad's government in early December, Hostage Aid Worldwide has searched buildings across Damascus for Tice and others believed to be held in Syria. The search for Austin Tice has intensified. Just before the regime collapsed, the Tice family announced they had verified evidence that Austin had been held in Damascus. Roger Carstens, the Biden administration's special envoy for hostage affairs, traveled to Damascus in late December with other U.S. officials. He spoke with U.S. media last month about the government's commitment to finding the journalists.
We have to help and or rather work with our interim authorities officials to make sure that we do a good search so that I can one day look Deborah Tice in the eyes and tell them that our search has been exhaustive.
Disappointed by the lack of U.S. progress, Deborah Tice returned to Syria this week to look for her son.
But the most important thing is, right now, at this moment, where is my son? Who is holding my son? It doesn't really matter where he was in 2018 or 2012. It doesn't matter.
Deborah Tice has confidence in the Donald Trump administration to help bring her son home.
His people have already reached out to me. I hadn't experienced that for the last 4 years. And so I'm very much looking forward to their help.
President Trump has nominated Middle East expert Adam Bowler to be his special envoy for hostage affairs and to work with families like the Tices. But for now, back in Damascus, the search for the journalist continues.
There is safe houses that we need to search for Austin Tice in safe houses in Damascus or in Latakia, as well as we need to check more the hospital's record to see if there is any evidence on Austin.
Deborah Tice says the family looks forward to the day Austin will walk free. Christina Caicedo-Smith, VOA News.
And that's going to wrap it up for us today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform. and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Steve Karasch.